you care about. WLBB, Carrollton, News Talk, 1330, FM 106.3.
Good morning. Welcome to the Community Voice. I'm Steve Graddick, your host. Delighted to have you with us this morning. I think it's a beautiful Tuesday, I have to think about it, morning. And it's Thanksgiving week, and we're honored to have again on the telephone line with us Dr. Laura Larson. Good morning, Dr. Larson.
Good morning.
Hey, good to have you with us. All right, a little bio as usual. Dr. Larson's Medical Director of Infection Prevention for Tanner Health System. She's board certified in both infectious diseases and internal medicine. She earned her medical degree from the Mercer University School of Medicine and completed her residency and fellowship at Shands Hospital at the University of Florida. She serves on the American Board of Internal Medicine Infectious Diseases, and she is chairman of the Carroll County Board of Health. And for our listeners, we're on 106.3 FM. We're also 1330 AM and on Facebook Live on the News Talk Facebook page. Well, it's good to have you back. I look forward to the day that we can talk about something other than COVID-19, but that'll be the topic for the day. If you would, as we normally do, bring us up on the latest stats locally.
Sure. So since this has started in March, we've done over 25,000 tests on patients now, and we're running about, for the tests done on our system, about over just over 4,000 positive tests. And so the numbers don't mean as much to me now as our percentage of tests that are positive, because that kind of lets me know how we're doing in terms of what portion of our community is actively testing positive. And so we've seen our numbers go up and down with that. The worst we had a percentage of positive tests was over 20% positive. And then our best has been less than 10% positive, or about 5 or 6% was our lowest. And right now we're running at 17% positive, which is, again, on an upward trajectory. Our peaks are more or less, I want to call them waves, because we never really had this completely go away. Obviously, we had a peak back in April. We had a peak back in July, and we're on an upward trajectory again right now for cases. So we're at 17% positive. The county is reporting about 15% positive, and the numbers are just going up for our percentage of positive cases again.
I heard coming in that since March, 25% of overall cases have occurred in the last month. Is that correct?
Nationwide, yes. We certainly are testing more than we were capable of testing back in the early days. But Georgia as a whole is under testing compared to the national average. So, but yes, we've had a dramatic increase nationwide in the last month.
With all that in mind, give us your take. We hear a lot about the mortality rate and how the mortality rate is better now than it was in the early days. And I understand that's in part because of the way we're defining cases versus infections, and we have all this testing. But the mortality rate, I understand, is going down. Isn't that a real good positive sign? And is that
it
correct?
Is. And we knew based on prior pandemics that all we had to go on when this started was what we call a case fatality rate. So that's how many people were dying that we knew had COVID. But we didn't know how many people actually had it. So there was a much broader net of people out there that were getting infected and maybe not even testing, and so we didn't really know. So we knew initially our case fatality rate, which early on was anywhere from 2 to 4%, was not going to be the overall death rate. And right now the estimates of the death rate are about 0.6%. And to compare that to, you know, flu is 0.1%, so it's still higher than our flu mortality rate. But our overall mortality rate compared to what we think was the true mortality rate back early in COVID, not the case fatality, but the mortality rate, was about 0.9%. And so we feel like with our interventions that we're doing now and how we're managing patients, that the overall mortality from COVID has dropped about 30% on how we're actively managing patients. And I think that's true. We're seeing that in hospitalized patients too. We're treating people differently than we were early on. You know, we're using dexamethasone, we're using remdesivir, and we're also, you know, we intubated patients very early on aggressively, and we're not doing that as aggressively as we are now. So we're trying to keep people off the ventilator because that's when people's mortality rates tend to be the highest is people that are on the ventilator, and whether or not that's because they needed it or the ventilator contributing to it, we really don't know.
Yeah, obviously, the first two or three weeks back in March was deemed to flatten the curve so that hospitals wouldn't be overwhelmed. How's Tanner doing currently in terms of the pressure on bed space?
The pressure on bed space is difficult. In the sense that we have borders now, and what that means is we have people that are in the emergency room that are admitted to the hospital, but they're still in the emergency room because they haven't gotten a hospital bed yet. But I think it's important to say that we have that happen to us almost every year, particularly going into fall for flu season. So, you know, we already are at the point where we do have some borders intermittently. And so that worries me that we're not even into flu season yet, obviously. But right now we're doing okay. We flexed in the spring when we, you know, increased our number of ICU beds. We increased our number of negative pressure rooms. And we'll continue to do the same thing. We're just going to take care of patients the best that we can. But, yeah, I'm nervous about fall. I really am. I hope that people continue to use preventative measures, and you know, I don't see a lot of good mask wearing locally, but I hope that people will change that with the numbers going up, because the masks are also going to be very important to protect against flu as well.
For peace of mind, the COVID patients at Tanner are separated, correct?
Yes, they're in negative pressure rooms on the different areas of the hospital, yes.
And that includes Villarica?
It does.
Okay, very good. Well, we're going to come back and we'll try to talk about some good news, and that's therapeutics and immunity and vaccines. But first, how about we hear from our fine sponsor, Tanner Health System and Oak Mountain Academy. We'll be back with more with Dr. Larson.
At Oak Mountain Academy, our academic excellence shines through innovation and a personalized educational experience. Our pre-K 3 through 12th grade environment offers a family-oriented atmosphere. We are an independent school with faith-based values and an academy honor code. Our academic standards prepare our students for college and beyond. I'm Patrick Duran, headmaster, inviting you to visit us on the mountain or at oakmountain.us. Come see how our warriors are creating legacies.
For more than 70 years, you have turned to Tanner Health System for your healthcare needs. As our community moves forward, Tanner is here for you. Strong, safe, and close to home. Routine medical appointments, urgent elective surgeries, and imaging are back on the calendar at our hospitals and Tanner Medical Group practices. With the safety of our patients, staff, and community always our top priority. Learn more at Tanner.org. Hashtag We Are Tanner Strong. That's Tanner.org. Hashtag We Are Tanner Strong.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Community Voice. I'm Steve Graddick, your host. We're honored to have via phone Dr. Laura Larson, Medical Director of Infection Prevention for Tanner Health System. It's easy for me to say. Well, we're going to try to put a little good news type of theme to this. Let's talk about therapeutics. I'm very interested. When the president contracted COVID, he got Regeneron, and I understand that's kind of a antibiotic treatment that's manufactured that's only good for early treatment, and yet it's has been approved by the FDA. Have you used Regeneron? What's your thoughts upon it?
So we can't get Regeneron yet. If you know, as this pandemic has shown us, a lot of therapeutics are available that don't get to all of the hospitals in a timely fashion. And our first, you know, experience with that was remdesivir. You know, remdesivir came out pretty early, but our hospital didn't get it until almost May. And so the monoclonal antibodies are going to be the same situation where they're going to be allocated by the federal and then state government, federals, then it goes to the State Department of Public Health, and then on to hospitals. What we have gotten is Lilly's monoclonal antibody. It's called bamlanivimab. And so we don't have Regeneron, but we do have the other monoclonal antibody that actually has been allocated quicker to us than Regeneron.
What is that called for, in your opinion?
Tell me again, what did you say, Steve?
When is that called for, in your opinion?
Well, it has really strict criteria. And so the criteria are the patient can't be hospitalized, the patient can't be on oxygen, or if a patient is chronically on oxygen, they can't have an increased rate. But there are a lot of people that potentially would qualify for this drug. So it can be given to anybody over a BMI of 35, which is, you know, the body mass index over 35, patients with chronic kidney disease, patients that are immunosuppressed, patients that are over 55 with heart conditions and lung conditions, and anybody over the age of 65 that has tested positive. So it's a really, we've only gotten a very small allocation of it. So it's very difficult to figure out exactly how to triage patients for this. So it's essentially what we're doing is people that have tested that are not short of breath but have high risk for progression to disease are patients that we're targeting with that monoclonal antibody.
By now, I think we've all have friends or family members that we know of that's had COVID. And in my world, in my experience level, I had different people I know, and the treatment has seemingly been across the board. Some were sent home with simply vitamin C. One was sent home with hydroxychloroquine, and he suffered for 30 days, and with the zinc and the Z-Pak and steroids and antibiotics. And then, you know, I've known one gentleman who was hospitalized in Atlanta for quite a while. It seems like the treatments and the way you tackle this is pretty wide variety. Am I wrong in that assessment?
No, you're right. I think a lot of people are using different methods of treatment. We try to follow the NIH and the Infectious Diseases Society of America guidelines. And right now, at least for outpatients, the recommendations, there's no recommendation necessarily for vitamin C and zinc. And we do it because it's not a harmful thing to do. And supportive care for outpatients, hydroxychloroquine is, again, not recommended, but I know it's still used by some clinicians. Azithromycin is used by clinicians. Right now, with those two separate guidelines, the only recommendations are for treating hospitalized patients requiring oxygen with dexamethasone and remdesivir. And there's even more studies coming out on remdesivir maybe not being good for the most critically ill. So right now, those two treatment modalities, the remdesivir and the dexamethasone, are really the only things that clinical trials are telling us that we should use in hospitalized patients requiring oxygen. The outpatient, really, there's no consensus on what's effective. And I think that's why you see a little bit of everything done.
What would you say to someone who, you know, has symptoms, gets tested, and is determined positive? They go to their local, you know, physician, family physician, internal medicine physician. How should the patient approach that? Do we kind of really have input on the treatment, or do we just leave it up to that local physician, or what do we do?
We really do leave it up to their clinician. You know, what I tell patients that I know that I test and that are positive outpatients is obviously to quarantine. You know, it still amazes me how patients have had reports of patients that are positive, still going to the gym, still going to work, things like that. But it's really important to quarantine so you don't infect others. And the quarantine time is 10 days from the onset of symptoms or the onset of the positive test if there are no symptoms. And then it's 20 days if that patient is immunosuppressed. So quarantine for the 10 days or 20 days if you're immunosuppressed. Supportive care, get plenty of rest, plenty of hydration. You know, vitamin C and zinc are fine. Again, that's something that's not harmful. We don't know if it helps, but it it's a recommendation that a lot of people make because it's not harmful. And then the most important thing is if you start developing shortness of breath, that is when you want to be evaluated, because that's the, you know, that's kind of a trigger for seeking more aggressive care and seeing if you need to be admitted to the hospital for the other treatments. You know, as we roll out the monoclonal antibody and we get more of that, there may be a role for, you know, patients getting that treatment modality if they're at high risk for progression disease. And we know, you know, since the beginning of all of this, we knew heart disease and diabetes were major risk factors, but the top three risk factors right now are age, and over, you know, 60 seems to be the number, male sex, and obesity. You know, those are the top three risk factors for progression to disease that we're recognizing right now.
We're trying to maintain a good theme. Let's talk about immunity for a moment. You know, as more and more people get it and recover from it, we start hearing almost boasting that, well, I'm immune now. I'm going to be immune for at least 6 months. What's the current understanding of what immunity is after for someone who's successfully had COVID and beat it?
Yeah, well, we don't really know how long immunity will work for people. I do know of two patients that we have readmitted that were clearly positive in the spring, and they're clearly positive again now with PCR tests and consistent disease. So two patients that I'm aware of that got reinfected, so their immunity did not last. I don't know. I think for most people, there probably is some immunity that is there. But it's not for everybody, and that's why I hope that people are still careful, you know, especially going into this holiday. I just want what we don't want to see in the hospital is a big wave of people getting sick after Thanksgiving, clearly.
We hear the term, we have since March, the term herd immunity bannered about, which basically I interpret simply being, you know, the more people get it, the less likely the rest of us are going to get it because we're all building up antibodies. What's a correct definition or a better definition of herd immunity?
You know, I think you're right. It's essentially that when there's enough disease in a community or enough people that have had a particular infection to where it protects the herd, essentially. So that you know, and for a lot of diseases, that number needs to be, you know, 80, 90% of the people have already had infection, so it's not transmitted much anymore. We don't know what that number is for COVID, and the state used to publish an overall number of positive cases, and they still do, but it hasn't moved as much as I had hoped. You know, we're seeing total antibody test percentage of positive, a number of tests in the state at 10%, but we know that number is higher than that because not everyone's getting tested for antibodies to see what that number is. But, you know, it's just essentially how many people had disease, how many people have immunity enough to protect the herd.
Again, trying to stay positive. Operation Warp Speed apparently has given us two U.S. vaccines, one from England. At what we're told, and I assume it's correct, that this is a remarkable achievement to get vaccines at this early date. What's your take on the vaccines, which are apparently just a few weeks around the corner, and apparently are going to be very effective?
So, you know, the way that we normally do vaccines does take longer. And these newer vaccines are mRNA vaccines, which are much easier to make, and they can be made much more quickly, which is why we have, you know, two mRNA vaccines, Moderna and Pfizer's vaccine, that are about to come to approval. They're very effective. That's, you know, in the studies of having 90 to 95% efficacy is remarkable for a vaccine because, you know, in a good year, the flu vaccine is 76 to 80% effective. So now we're looking at a vaccine that's potentially, you know, 95% effective. I enrolled in a clinical trial for the Moderna vaccine and was randomized to either the vaccine or placebo and did that in September. So it's still, I don't know which I got yet. I feel pretty strongly about getting the ability to be protected when taking care of patients, and that's why I enrolled in a trial pretty early on. So I went through that process.
So you're confident in the safety of these vaccines?
I really am. And it's, the downside in the ID world is that a lot of the ID thought leaders were worried that they wouldn't be effective enough as an mRNA vaccine. We've had mRNA vaccines for other diseases already that have been, worked on. So that was the concern in the ID world, that they weren't going to be effective enough. But at least on early information, it looks like they really are very effective.
So, but yet in the beginning, they're going to be targeted toward the elderly, those at high risk. Will they be therefore part of a prescription, or how will they be allocated or administered?
So this will be allocated again, like remdesivir has been, and like bamlanivimab have been allocated as well. We will get federal guidance that will go to the state departments of public health. We've already gotten that guidance actually on priority groups. And then hospitals or clinical practices have signed up with the departments of public health as a pod or a point of distribution. And so our hospital system has been set up as a public pod, meaning that we will vaccinate, the community, people that want that. My understanding is that the vaccine is going to be completely free coming from the federal government. And I believe that we've elected to offer the vaccination, administration for free as well from our hospital system. So it will roll out probably next month to the high priority groups. And as those, as the vaccine comes in, we will just continue to work through the groups going forward. It's happening. We're actually getting this much faster than I would have thought possible.
It does seem like a very remarkable achievement. It was only in March, and no one knew. We didn't have a clue as to what the coronavirus was or anything. And here it is, end of November, to have a vaccine that's effective and. It seems like an absolutely remarkable achievement.
It really is. It's amazing, actually.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Laura Larson, Medical Director of Infection Prevention for Tanner Health System, and we're going to be back and wrap it up with Dr. Larson after these words.
For more than 70 years, you have turned to Tanner Health System for your healthcare needs. As our community moves forward, Tanner is here for you. Strong, safe, and close to home. Routine medical appointments, urgent elective surgeries, and imaging are back on the calendar at our hospitals and Tanner Medical Group practices, with the safety of our patients, staff, and community always our top priority. Learn more at Tanner.org. Hashtag We Are Tanner Strong. That's Tanner.org. Hashtag We Are Tanner Strong.
A well-rounded education includes much more than just academics. At Oak Mountain Academy, we encourage our students to find their niche in any of our 42 co-curricular opportunities. Over the past 5 years, we have brought home 5 state and 20 regional athletic titles. Our one-act play and literary teams continuously compete at the region and state level, and our academic teams bring home first place more than not. We are warriors creating legacies. To learn more, visit oakmountain.us.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Community Voice. I'm Steve Graddick, your host. We have Dr. Laura Larson on the line, Medical Director of Infections Prevention for Tanner, and we're talking about COVID, and as usual, we're going to run out of time, so let's see if we can breeze through some of these things real quick. You mentioned masks earlier. As we approach Thanksgiving, we have a question from Nikki Bishop. She wants to know, are face shields as effective as masks, and why do some states say no and some say yes?
There aren't a lot of studies on face shields. The ones that I've been able to find, they're protective, more protective for the people not wearing them. The people that wear them still have increased rates of infection versus wearing a mask in the studies that have been done. So I don't recommend them over a mask. When I see patients, obviously I wear a mask and a face shield, but I don't recommend a face shield instead of a mask.
Okay.
At this time.
As chairman of the Carroll County Board of Health, you know, this pandemic, and I don't think anybody can deny it, has been politicized in so many different ways this past year. When we hear about lockdowns, statewide, authorized by governors or mayors or whatever, we often think about the mental health consequences of such lockdowns. I mean, it's extremely stressful, not only for the economic situation, but just for life in general. What's your take on these massive lockdowns, which I understand have never really been utilized before?
Yeah, I would just rather people mask than be locked down. That's my personal take. I mean, I would rather have a more aggressive mask mandate, which is not very popular either. I would rather do that than lock down. I mean, lockdown has had huge consequences economically, psychologically for people. And I just feel like if we did a better job wearing masks, we wouldn't need to do that. I mean, and that's been shown over and over in countries where mask wearing is much more, just done. You know, if you look at some of our countries in Asia where people wear masks routinely, there are countries there that have had a COVID case in months now. So it's just, I would prefer that to a lockdown.
We, along the same lines, every day the national media, anyway, tends to give us the latest total stats on the number of deaths in America brought about by COVID. And I often wonder if they did the same thing for cancer and heart disease and car accidents. I think we'd all be afraid to leave the house. Is that kind of reporting irresponsible, in your opinion?
It would be nice if it were more relative. You know, all we talk about is COVID. Now, the number of COVID deaths are remarkable compared to some other diseases, but it would be nice if we had something to take it in context with. And obviously, I mean, I know that we're very weary talking about COVID. It's everything we hear about. I'm very weary seeing everything with it too, because there's still a lot of misinformation out there. So, yes, I mean, I think that it's somewhat irresponsible, but at the same time, we've got so many people dying and so many some places not taking it seriously. So, it's a hard topic.
Let me ask you this one. This is probably should have been in the previous segment, but I've just learned of a phenomenon called long haulers, which apparently are COVID patients who are taking an incredibly long time to get over the symptoms. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe it?
There are just patients that have had COVID that have lingering symptoms. And in most cases, it's fatigue and shortness of breath. And on workup with testing, everything looks like it's fine. Like, it looks like there's nothing wrong, but patients are still having symptoms. Some patients are having long-term mental fatigue or mental fog. So, yes, we're definitely seeing that in a subset of our patients.
I don't want to completely run out of time without asking you about the healthcare workers, particularly locally. Not only at Tanner, but in every assisted living, memory care, nursing home in our area. You know, we're all kind of COVID crazy, COVID weary, just strung out, talking, thinking about COVID. But how are the healthcare workers and those that are trying to protect our elderly, how are they doing physically, mentally? I assume y'all are more than exhausted.
Yeah, I think people are tired. And I think that, you know, that I've had some colleagues in nursing that, you know, used to work in ICU that just don't work there anymore. It's been very difficult to see people get sick and die, and then people get sick and not die, and that should be a very positive thing. But the problem is that, you know, for us in healthcare, seeing the community not really mask as much as we'd like is so disheartening, and because we feel like a lot of this could have been averted. And so people are tired, I do think, but we're getting, you know, this is our job and this is what we do. And this is, you know, we're still here.
Now, when they mask, just a quick reminder, they need to mask properly, correct?
Correct.
And that
nose and mouth.
And then don't pull it down. Don't put your hands all over everything. And, you know.
Yeah.
So for it to be effective. Well, we're going to run out of time, but we certainly want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving. And
Thank you.
I assume that you would encourage everyone to be safe this Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Keep it as small as you can. I'm packing up plates for my parents and taking it and dropping them off. So just keep people safe.
We salute you and salute all the healthcare workers that have been trying to keep us safe and treating us during this pandemic. But most of all, we hope everyone can have a very happy and safe Thanksgiving. We thank our sponsors and we thank you for listening to the Community Voice here on WLBB Carrollton.
National headlines and the local stories you care about. WLBB Carrollton News Talk 1330 FM 106.3.